This is a trimmed down podcast version of Tracks of My Life from RNIB Connect Radio. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to this special RNIB Connect Radio 20th anniversary episode of Tracks of My Life. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life, from maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest today is Dr. Hazel McFarlane, MBE, a disability activist and researcher who has been working in and alongside the sight loss and disability sectors for over 30 years. Hazel's contribution to the sight loss sector was acknowledged earlier this year when she was awarded an MBE for services to people with sight loss in the King's Birthday Honours List. Hello, Hazel, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me to do this.
The first track you've chosen, Hazel, is actually one of your sister Christine's, and it takes you back to early life growing up and sneaking into her room and listening to Don't Go Breaking My Heart by Elton John and Kiki Dee. What was early family life like for you, Hazel, and also having a twin sister too?
Yeah, so I had I have a twin sister and two older sisters. So my twin sister's Heather and Christine and Joan, who are 6 and 9 years older than me. So our house was always really busy. It was always full of people and just really good fun. And for me, it was great having a twin sister because, you know, you always had a best friend to be by your side. And also it meant that I had an expectation that I would just do the same things as her, despite the fact that I had, you know, significant vision impairment as a child. I was kind of unaware of that, really.
Were you the only person in your family who had poor sight?
Yeah. My sister and I were born 12 weeks prematurely. Heather was 4 pounds when she was born and I was 2 pounds. We should have been born at the end of June and we were born in the middle of March. So, the main eye condition I have is retinopathy of prematurity because of that. So my parents had never encountered sight loss before until I was born.
And how did your family, I suppose, react to the fact that you had, you know, poor sight, and how did they support you growing up as a visually impaired child?
My parents were quite political, and, you know, one thing, when I was due to go to primary school, my mum had gone and researched the legislation and realised that I could attend my local mainstream school. My parents had been approached for me to attend the Royal Blind School in Edinburgh, but they wanted me to go to the same school as my twin sister. So particularly my mum researched all the legislation and then went to the local primary school and insisted that I had a place at the local primary school, which in some ways was great, but at the time it was very unusual. I mean, I'm in my 50s, so it was really unusual for a child with sight loss to be in mainstream education. But my parents very much felt that a vision impairment shouldn't hold me back from doing whatever I wanted to do.
What memories come back to you, Hazel, when you hear Don't Go Breaking My Heart by Elton John and Kiki Dee?
Well, as you said, sneaking into my big sister's bedroom when they were out. And both my sisters were quite different. Joan's very tidy and Christine at the time wasn't. So when I used to go into their bedroom, it was as if someone had drawn a line down the middle of the room. One half was really super tidy and the other half was a bit of a bird's nest. But I used to love going into their room when they were out and secretly playing with, you know, playing their records and listening to the different music that they liked. And so that's my instant memory as our family home in Brassey at the time. And I can still remember, you know, the colour of their carpet. They had this purple carpet, which must have been the 1970s, which had been really, really popular then, but it was probably absolutely awful.
Elton John and Kiki Dee there with Don't Go Breaking My Heart and fond family memories for you too, Hazel. We now come to a time in your life, Hazel, when you were very much involved in the disability rights movement in the sort of early 1990s. What made you want to get involved in the disability rights movement at that time?
Yeah, I had a qualification in a BSc in horticulture and plant biotechnology. It's recombinant DNA in plant biotechnology. So I really wanted to go into plant science. But I guess attitudinal barriers, people couldn't conceive, you know, how could somebody, at the time I was partially sighted, how would I actually operate working at a molecular level? And there were already adaptations, you know, you could get computer screens that linked up to microscopes. So if you were doing a cell count, you were able to just look at a large screen rather than look down the microscope. And it was really experiencing quite blatant discrimination and having absolutely no redress at all that started to make me want to get involved in changing that. And up until that point, I'd actually concealed my vision impairment all through school. I covered it up. I worked really hard to cover it up all the time. And most people that I was at school with didn't realise that I had a significant sight loss. So in the 1990s, I just happened to find out about a job that had come up in a disability-led organisation called Accessibility Lothian. And it was part of the Lothian Coalition of Disabled People. And it was a project that promoted inclusive education, which at the time, that term was really unheard of. So it was quite pioneering. So for me, being involved in the Lothian Coalition of Disabled People, being involved in a disability-led project, and the whole campaign around disability rights, that campaign was called the Last Civil Rights Movement, because at the time, disabled people had no civil rights, we had no redress for discrimination that we encountered. And it was just such an empowering time to be involved, and really empowering as a disabled person. And when I say disabled person, I am talking about the social model definition. So I very much take the view that it's societal, you know, attitudinal, organisational, physical barriers that truly create people. Those barriers are the disabling factor rather than an impairment per se. So I sort of came out as a disabled person, being part of that disability pride, resorting to civil disobedience to get that legislation through. And because a lot of the time, non-disabled people were very much unaware of the barriers that disabled people encountered. So actually that civil disobedience and disrupting public transport, for example, meant that it brought the issue to the fore and made people aware of the fact that for lots of people, simple everyday things that most people take for granted were not accessible to a number of disabled people. So it was great fun. You know, I had one demonstration that I was on, I was handcuffed to a wheelchair user and we couldn't be arrested because the police vans weren't accessible. So, you know, it was like stuff like that. It was just great. It was great fun.
Yeah, I remember seeing all the news reports of many disabled people sort of chaining themselves to buses and blocking the roads and stuff and trying to make change at the government of that time. And it was quite sort of powerful, the sort of imagery of disabled people sort of blocking roads and everything else. It was very powerful at that time.
Yeah, I think it really turned everything on its head, because I think up until that point we were very much constructed as passive recipients. And actually, as a movement, it just gained momentum and people demanded rights. They wanted civil rights. And actually, I think that shift in attitude and disabled people saying, you know what, we demand this rather than, well, we'll accept what you're willing to give to us. And actually, when the Disability Discrimination Act 1995 came into statute, the movement was really disappointed with that legislation, so they continued to campaign to get the legislation closer to basically have some teeth so that people would have some sort of redress.
Hey, so what is the track that takes you back to those disability movement days in the early 1990s, and why this particular track?
It's Laddie Siffre, Something Inside So Strong. This was playing at an event that I went to, but I just love the opening lyric. You know, the higher you build your barriers, the harder I will fight. And to me, that sums up the disability movement that I was involved in. We wanted to fight harder to break down those barriers that we encountered.
The higher you build your barriers, the taller I become. The farther you take my rights away, the faster I will run.
Laddie Siffre there, and Something Inside So Strong, and some very powerful lyrics too. We now have a track, Hazel, that is dedicated to your son, Michael, and takes you back to when you and him were dancing along to this track as a toddler. And this is going to probably be a bit of an obvious question, but I'm going to ask it. Do you think that bringing up a child is harder for somebody who's visually impaired, or is that just a bit of a myth and it's just hard bringing up a child no matter whether you're visually impaired, disabled or sighted?
When I had my son, somebody said to me, it's the hardest job and the most wonderful job that you'll ever do. And that has stuck with me. I think I encountered attitudes towards me that were quite negative from medical professionals from when I was 9 weeks pregnant. And that actually prompted me to go and do my PhD, because I wanted to find out if other women who were blind or who had any sort of physical impairment, had they encountered the same. So I think sometimes attitudes can be really difficult. And when my son, even was about four, you know, if we were out together, get people coming up to him and saying, oh, are you looking after your mum? And I used to not challenge that, but actually I had some issues with my son's behaviour, and that's because I realised that people outside our home were giving him the message that he was the adult and I was the child. So actually I then had to start saying to people, no, he's four, he's a child, and I'm looking after him. But even now that my son's an adult, people quite often assume that he's got a caring role in my life. And he actually doesn't live at home anymore, but people quite often just make that assumption. And even when he was a child, that assumption did, you know, we both encountered that quite often. So I think that makes it harder because I was very conscious of people having that notion that he cared for me, that I wasn't a carer for him. So that does make things a bit tricky. But I think parenting is a hard job. You know, you don't have a manual that you can go and read, but it is fantastic. And now my son's an adult and we're getting to that stage, and I can't believe it, he's 25 this year. I feel as though I blinked when he was two and the last 23 years have just gone by in a flash. But we are getting to the stage now where we're equal. Our relationship is equal, he's an adult, and we're getting to a stage where we're more friends than parent and child. So that's actually really nice. You know, we can go out for meals together and have a good go and chat, and I really enjoy that. But I loved it when he was a toddler. We just had so much fun. And so this track, I don't hear it so often now. I mean, it probably is a terrible song, but actually it was just a bit of fun. And we used to do silly dances around our sitting room. And any time I do hear it, I'm straight back there. And it just makes me smile.
And the track is Mambo Number 5. And it's a very sort of move. So it's a track that you would instantly probably get up and dance to. And I wondered whether you and Michael might still dance to that track if it comes on the radio or played on your smart speaker.
Yeah, do you know, we would. Because I had a party recently and there was another song that we used to dance to. And I got him up to dance and he's like, no, Mum, it has to be Mambo Number 5.
Jump up and down and move it all around. Shake your head to the sound, put your hands on the ground. Take one step left and one step right. One to the front and one to the side. Clap your hands once and clap your hands twice. And if it looks like this, then you're doing it. A little bit of Monica in my life.
Mambo number 5 there, and a track that I think will get everyone up and dancing if they heard it. Hazel, we now have a track that marks the time when you gained your PhD in 2005. But going through education, as I think you've probably maybe mentioned, was not quite really as good as it possibly could be. And in a way, slightly sort of rare situation, because you were in mainstream education, while for me, at that time, I was going through education in the 70s and 80s. I was in a specialist school for visually impaired children, and a boarding school too, which I don't know, maybe was possibly the best place for me at that time. I don't know. But I wondered how supportive was the school that you were at, and you know, did you get the right support that you needed in the classroom?
I think there was a lack of awareness, really. And that lack of awareness was probably on my part as well, because I sort of concealed my vision impairment. I didn't really ever compare notes on what I could see and what other people could see. And that was probably vastly different. At primary school, I always had to sit at the front of the class so that I could see what was being written up on the blackboards. But I think I still struggled, because when the teacher explained things, I could follow it. But as soon as I was left to go on with a task, I often struggled. But that's because quite often the task was written up on the board and I was struggling to see it. But as a child, didn't realise that. And then when I went to secondary school, again, there was no, you know, again, I think just through lack of awareness. You know, for example, I was trying to memorise my way around a large secondary school, because when I went from being outside where it's quite bright into a large old building that was quite dark, it took a long time for my eyes to adjust. And so I was often walking about just going on memory. And that actually took a huge amount of energy. In terms of support, the only sort of acknowledgement that I had in terms of access was it, you know, so at the time, this is how long ago it was, when I was doing my O levels and highers, I got the papers in large print and I got to sit the exam in a separate room, because one of the exams I'd done earlier at school was in the assembly hall, and I just couldn't read the paper because the lighting was so poor. So I did really badly, which meant that I was in the bottom class just about for everything. And so, you know, so quite often I was sort of identified as someone who wasn't very bright, but in actual fact, I just couldn't read the exam papers to answer the questions. So it was a bit bizarre that when it came to O levels and highers, it was acknowledged that I did actually have to have larger print in a brighter room, and those things were accommodated at those exams. It wasn't until well after I left school that I went back and looked at my O-level and higher results and realised that the subjects that were not reliant on communicating information via a blackboard, I had done really well. So I was really good at English and geography, biology, because a lot of the time they weren't reliant on the board, but things like maths, I was absolutely dire. So that's when it clicked for me, that actually when things were made accessible, I did a lot better.
It's a sort of interesting debate, isn't it, that whether mainstream education or specialist education is the best for visually impaired children and disabled children as well. And, you know, for me, when I was going for education at that time, it was the best for me. But I would have perhaps preferred to have gone, you know, to the local comp where my brothers went and everything else, and not being sent away to boarding school. But, you know, I had a good time. But it's sort of interesting, because I think that, you know, sort of if the right support is there, then I think it's good for everybody. It's good for the visually impaired child, and it's good for the rest of the school and their classmates and everything else. But it's whether that support is there. And I'm not totally sure whether I think it is fair at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, mainstream environments that are well resourced for disabled children and young people are good environments, because it enables you to make friendship networks in your local area. And actually, where I live, I moved back. So I was from Troon, and I moved back to Troon when my son was quite young. I think he was about 14 months old when I moved back here. But a number of my friends did as well. So actually, a number of my friends that I now that I have in my friendship network now, we were all at school together. And I think, again, it's that equity with people who really got to know me, who were good friends when I was at school, have remained good friends throughout my life. I think there's something about that, that there's not a separate special world. You know, we all have to work in a mainstream society. It should be just everybody's experience is different, and it has to be what works for an individual child. But certainly for me, going through a mainstream environment gave me a resilience that has stayed with me.
And Hazel, you did end up doing your PhD, and I wonder if you could just maybe give me a little bit of an insight as to the subject. I think you've hinted a little bit about it, but it would be good to sort of just get a little bit more about what your PhD was all about.
Yeah, I mean, initially, because in a PhD you spend about 3 months researching and finding like all the work that's already been done, and you firm up your idea of what you're actually going to research. And initially I was looking to research disabled women who had children, but I actually really quickly realised that there was a really significant story in women who didn't have children. So actually my PhD, the title of it is Disabled Women and Socio-Spatial Barriers to Motherhood, and that's about how society shapes decisions. So 50% of the women who took part had children and 50% didn't. And that's just an absolute chance happening, because women self-selected to take part. But I was really looking at women's experience of having or not having children. And actually the women who came forward, it covered like 6 decades. So it was incredible to chart how things had changed or stayed the same over that time. But the other part of my PhD that I did was a historical review of the Glasgow and Edinburgh blind asylums. And actually that history from 1792 in the Edinburgh blind asylum, the history that I found in the minute books of those institutions shed light on the contemporary experiences. So it was amazing. It was so fascinating. It was just fantastic. And actually anyone who went to the local school here is eligible for a book allowance from the C.K. Marr Trust. And at one point when I was doing my undergrad, I had to take some time out to have eye surgery, and I had received a cheque for my book allowance, and I actually sent it back to the Trust and explained that I was going to have to take some time out to have eye surgery. And they came back to me and said, "You're the first person in the history of the Trust who has actually ever returned a cheque. So if we can help you in any way, please do get in touch." So they actually helped me with specialist assistive technology during my undergrad. But I went back to them with a PhD proposal to say, you know, would they be willing to fund my PhD? And they gave me a scholarship, and they were incredibly generous. And without them, I couldn't have done it. But it was the most inclusive educational experience I've had. And Professor Christopher Philo and Dr. Stella Lauder, who were my PhD supervisors, just went above and beyond what I could have expected of them. They were fantastic. So I just loved it, and I did really well in my PhD, because actually I could make it work for me, and it was accessible. So it was a fantastic experience.
Your next track is Proud by Heather Small, and I wondered how proud you feel now, having got through all that research and have done your PhD.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, for me, being at school and being considered not very bright, to me it felt like being framed for a crime that I didn't commit. So in a way, attaining a PhD, for me, validated that I was right. It wasn't me that was the problem. It wasn't my intellectual capacity. It was the environment that wasn't geared up to include me. But I do accept that at the time, there was very little in terms of track record of children and young people with sight loss being included in mainstream environments. What have you done today to make you feel proud? It's never too late to try. What have you done today to make you feel proud? Mm-hmm. Proud by Heather Smallvere, and I think we all should be proud of all of our achievements in our lives too. We now have a track, Hazel, that marks the time when you met your partner. And I think this piece of music is something that I don't think many people perhaps fully understand, or maybe they just sort of think of it as marking one occasion when this piece of music is played. It is, of course, Nimrod from Elgar's Enigma Variations, and obviously people have the sort of the link with Remembrance Sunday and everything else. But Hazel, I wanted to ask, how did you and your partner first meet first? Well, do you know, we'd actually known each other for years, just through the fact that we both worked in the sort of sight loss sector. And he's a bit of a cheeky chappy. People will know him, Jamie Cuthbertson, and he's known for being quite cheeky. And I used to think, God, he's so cheeky. But then he was working in the Macular Society as the Senior Regional Manager for Scotland, and he'd decided to retire. And I ended up getting his job. So when I started, I was on a huge learning curve, and he was really supportive towards me, and I just saw him in a different light. You know, just thought, gosh, he's actually incredibly kind. And then, of course, lockdown happened, and during lockdown, we kept in touch, and we were both competing with each other on the Joe Wicks workout, because there's 7 levels. So we were competing to see who was going to get to level 7 and who was going to stay at level 7 for the longest. And we're both quite competitive. So during lockdown, we sort of got to know each other a bit more. And then his family, we're going with them to London to celebrate his birthday, because they'd been unable to celebrate that during lockdown. But just before that, we had arranged to go on a date. So you're right in that the piece of music is associated with Remembrance, because Jamie was at the he's got a military background, and he was at the Remembrance ceremony with his family. And I was listening to it on the radio. And I usually wouldn't, but because he was there, I decided that I would listen to it. And Nimrod played, and it was live, and I just thought it was incredible. It just made the hairs in the back of my neck stand on end. So now that piece of music always makes me think of him.
Nimrod there from Elgar's Enigma Variations, and a track that marks the time when you met your partner, Hazel. We now have a track, Hazel, that takes you back to New Year's Eve 2019, which is pre-COVID times, and a family sort of dinner and get-together with your parents and your sister's family too. What was the sort of lead-up to this dinner? Was there much preparation, and what was on the menu?
Yeah, I mean, so my parents were both really good cooks, and actually the 4 of us have all grown up enjoying cooking. So I was always slightly anxious about having them round for dinner, because you think, oh, I've got to do a good job. I actually can't remember what was on the menu, but I know that I would have been probably cooking dinner for the bulk of the day, and making sure that it was absolutely perfect. Basically, and particularly because it was the 31st of December, it was Hogmanay, and just to have you know, really nice food and have everybody around, because my sister and her family live down south, so we don't, you know, we don't see each other that often. So it was a sort of fairly special occasion for us. So yeah, but this, I chose this track because, you know, we'd all had a few drinks over dinner, and so we were all, we play this game where you have to, each person gets the opportunity to select a piece of music, ask an Alexa, but they have to say why they've chosen it. And we usually start off with daft things, like, you know, from your childhood. So, you know, some of our sort of core favourites are like Pinky and Perky, you know, things that are just daft. And then we sort of boil it down a little bit more into things that are more meaningful. But my dad asked for this track, and then he got my mum up to dance, which was just lovely because, you know, at that point, they'd been married for 65 years and they bickered like mad the whole time. My mum always said that that's what kept their relationship alive, because they bickered. But actually, you could see that there was still that romance within the relationship, and they still absolutely loved each other, you know, even though they bickered, they always looked out for each other. So this song, that's what I always think of. And it was just such a sort of special moment, actually. And my parents passed away last year within a month of each other, which was really difficult because my mum's death was absolutely unexpected. So it was so close to my dad's that, you know, that was really difficult. And Jackie Winning from the Forth Valley Sensory Centre sent me a lovely email, and it said, you know, just now all the happy memories will be really difficult, but in time they'll bring you comfort. And that was so true, you know, it absolutely does. So, you know, I'm glad that I've got to the point where you can have a memory that actually makes you smile rather than makes you cry.
And what was the track that your dad chose that your parents danced to, and how precious is this track to you?
Yeah, it was Eva Cassidy, Over the Rainbow. So yeah, I can listen to it when I'm in my house, but I think when sometimes if I hear it and I'm not expecting it, it just catches you a little bit unawares. But that was the track, so it's a beautiful track. So
your parents' chosen track there, and some wonderful memories of New Year's Eve 2019 for you, Hazel. We now come to your final track, the one that you might like to pass on that might give hope for the future. Hazel, what is the track and why have you chosen it?
Yeah, this is just my all-time favourite song. So all my close friends know that this is my favourite song, and any time, you know, we're putting music on when we all get together, I'll always try and sneak this in at some point. But it's Louis Armstrong's Wonderful World. And I think for me, the song makes me think that actually life is about looking for the simple things in life that bring you joy. And also that actually, you know, if you love someone, then tell them. Don't tell them, just let them know. So, you know, a lot of my friends, you know, when we finish conversations or we're saying goodbye, you know, we'll say, I love you. Because I think that's really important, that actually people who are around you know that you love them.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Hazel, for sharing your Tracks of My Life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.